Blog Talk Radio. I have a wonderful Friday show for you. We have some big news here about a potential VP pick. I'm going to lead with that in just a second. We also have some unprecedented poll numbers about the election. Typically, what happens is whenever a president is at the end of their 8 years in office, nobody likes him. Usually people are like, we're done with you. Not so much the case this time around, and there's actually a lot to take away from that. Not only in the sense of what Obama's done, but also more along the lines of just how disastrous the next two major candidates are. Then we also have, I somehow missed this story from 2 or 3 days ago, but there's a hideous Supreme Court decision that happened that was unanimous. We're going to cover it today. It's about money and politics. Then we revisit Nate Silver and his wild prediction on what Hillary Clinton's chances are. And we got a whole bunch more, including transgender troops can now serve openly in the military. Boom. What's up, bitch? And that's effective immediately. If I didn't say that already. And then also Christianity in America. Guess what? When you poll Christians, they go, oh my God, we are like so super oppressed in America. So I will be discussing about how they are not. All right, so let's get started here. And we're going to do that with some big straightforward political news here about the election. Some big news here about the 2016 presidential race. This is from Talking Points Memo. They say Donald Trump's campaign has been vetting New Jersey Governor Chris Christie as a possible running mate, according to a Thursday report from the New York Times. Christie has received the official paperwork for the process, an unnamed source also told CNN. Now, apparently Chris Christie is on the short list here, and there's a reason why this sounds particularly credible and noteworthy this time around. So there's been whispers about him maybe becoming VP going back for a while now, but I think we're much closer to that being the case because of the fact that Donald Trump is Donald Trump, and there's no doubt that many in the Republican establishment really, really don't like him. Now, Republican-based voters like him. I mean, that's why he won the primary. So the base voters are all in the tank for Trump, but the Republican establishment is not. Neoconservatives, there are some prominent neoconservatives who've actually endorsed Hillary Clinton. So, you know, you look at people like Bill Kristol, you look at some of the big money donors, Paul Singer, a Republican billionaire donor, all these people are like, we really, really dislike Trump. The Koch brothers don't like Trump. So the Republican establishment is against him, which means that many, many in the Republican establishment have just outright dismissed the idea that they would ever be Trump's VP because they view that on some level, in all seriousness, as political suicide because everybody thinks that Hillary Clinton's going to win. Everybody thinks she's the favorite. And they think, well, if I, you know, run with him as VP, I'm going to be the next Sarah Palin, if you will, where now, you know, everybody kind of realizes Sarah Palin is a joke. She was a joke all along, but now it's just so obvious that she's a joke. And then most people have some degree of shame where they don't want to attach themselves to a Trump ticket. And I wouldn't be surprised if Trump has been searching all over the place for somebody to be a VP outside of somebody like Amorosa. So who's left? Well, so many people have said, don't consider me. I'm not interested in that. Well, Chris Christie was the guy who was Trump's little bitch all along. Chris Christie was the guy who famously was behind Trump while he's giving a speech with that sad, sad look on his face, like, yeah, I just made a deal with the devil. That's what I did. Now, a lot of people thought, including myself, he might have been gunning for something more along the lines of attorney general. But if it comes down to it and he has no other option, would he go with somebody like Chris Christie? Yeah, even though Chris Christie's not that liked by many Republicans, period, at this point. He's really disliked if you look at the poll numbers. But that I don't think that would stop Trump. Now, that would set up a really, really, really interesting dynamic, too. Because then you'd have Donald Trump, loudmouth, faux straight shooter, and Chris Christie, loudmouth, faux straight shooter, against Hillary Clinton and whoever she happens to pick. Now, if Trump indeed does go with Chris Christie, I think it'd be crazy for Hillary Clinton not to pick Elizabeth Warren. Because here's the thing. When you have the bullies, and they are bullies, I mean, call it what it is. They pretend like they're straight shooters, but they're not. They lie all the time. When you have people like that, you have to undercut their arguments and do it quick and do it effectively and do it in a strong way. The only person who you can see doing that and you can rest assured they do it right is somebody like Elizabeth Warren. And historically, people view the VP as the president's attack dog. Now, we get it. Trump doesn't really need an attack dog. He's his own attack dog. But for Hillary Clinton, you know, the idea that there's somebody who's more aggressive and who can make the case in a really clear way and black and white way, like Elizabeth Warren, that would really benefit her. And if Trump goes with Chris Christie and Hillary doesn't go with Elizabeth Warren, I think that hurts her chances. But if she does go with Elizabeth Warren, if he goes with Chris Christie, I really do think that ups her chances big time. Now, I get it, and I'm in the camp that was upset that Elizabeth Warren didn't endorse Bernie Sanders. I'm in the camp that now doesn't view her as a pure progressive. I think she's like a watered-down version of Bernie Sanders, even though she still has a great record. So, I was upset that she didn't endorse Bernie Sanders. But do I think that Elizabeth Warren being on the ticket will end up helping Hillary with getting many more people who were Bernie voters who really, really don't like Hillary Clinton and still don't like Hillary Clinton? I think the answer to that is yes. It's a statistics game, and it's like, how many more will you get if you go in that direction and if you put somebody on the ticket who has a pretty good progressive record? I think you will get more, and that is who Hillary Clinton needs, by the way. She needs she needs millennials. Elizabeth Warren would help with that. And also, it would just be amazing to see those debates. Could you imagine a Chris Christie versus Elizabeth Warren VP debate? Oh, that'd be so great, because Chris Christie, again, he would pretend like he knows shit because he has the faux straight shooter thing going on, and Elizabeth Warren actually knows shit. So I could just see her being like, no, you're wrong. You're wrong, Chris. Here's why you're wrong. Let me explain this very simply. Chris is like, oh, I'm the straight shooter. Oh, fuck, you just exposed me. That's right. That's exactly what happened. So, and then I guess the final point to make about this is you really would set up like almost a classic gender roles thing. Like Donald Trump and Chris Christie kind of embody that old school, you know, macho man 1950s masculine dominant role of like, yeah, I'm going to tell you what's going on here. I'm the man. I'm strong. Look at me. Oh, yeah, I'm an alpha male type A personality over here. Like, they embody that. And then on the flip side, if you had Hillary Clinton and Elizabeth Warren, you guys know I despise Hillary Clinton because her record is disastrous and she's just really not progressive. But if you have Elizabeth Warren, for example, making these arguments and basically giving facts to rebut somebody like Chris Christie, it's like classic, you know, over-the-top, stereotypical masculine role versus the fact-checking female who's like, yeah, let me actually correct your punk ass. So, I mean, it would be absolutely fascinating. It'd be super interesting to watch. But then again, look, at this point, it really is all speculation because, yeah, there are leaks here, but do we know for sure yet? No, we don't know for sure. I mean, this is more evidence pointing in the direction that Trump will pick Christie. but we still don't know for sure. And with Hillary Clinton, there's more evidence that she would pick Elizabeth Warren, even though at the beginning I thought there's a 0% chance of that. But now she's on the campaign trail with her, and they've been leaking stories and dropping hints here and there. So there's a better chance, and there's some evidence to suggest that Hillary will pick Elizabeth Warren. But again, even that's speculation, and we don't know. But it would be super, super fascinating if you had Donald Trump and Chris Christie versus Hillary Clinton and Elizabeth Warren. Okay. Boom. We're off and running, bitches. All right, now let's move along. We have some unprecedented poll numbers here about the 2016 election. The Hill explains, a strong majority of Democrats would cancel the 2016 presidential election between Hillary Clinton and Donald Trump if it meant President Obama could serve another term. Data provided to the Hill by the conservative polling outlet WPA Research found that 67% of Democrats would take a third term for Obama over a potential Clinton administration. Only 28% said they're ready to move on from the Obama White House, while 6% are undecided. Okay, now, you can take this with a grain of salt, because like I said, conservative polling outlet, WPA Research, you know, I'd view this the same as I view a Rasmussen poll, for example, skewed a little bit to the right, you can say, or a Fox News poll. But is there something here? Are they getting at something? Yes, they're certainly getting at something. And that something is not even necessarily, oh, my God, we love Obama so much. No, that something is, what have we gotten ourselves into? It's going to be either Donald Trump or Hillary Clinton. So this more speaks to how much Democrats, but the American people in general, dislike Donald Trump and Hillary Clinton. Now, with Obama, I mean, he's a mixed bag. I mean, I don't know what else to say about it. I'm super upset with him and annoyed with him because in so many ways he abandoned progressive principles and he stopped being liberal and he also just concedes the Republicans over and over and over. And that's his downside. His downside is also he's a center-right corporatist Democrat, so he does to a large extent sell out to Wall Street, and there's multiple examples of that. But on the flip side, there are instances where he's done a decent job and we should give him credit when he does a decent job. So, for example, I give him credit for Obamacare. Now, I wanted single payer. We had a supermajority at the time. We could have got it if he knew how to twist arms and play politics and if he really wanted it. But we didn't get it, so I'm upset about that. But still, Obamacare is a step in the right direction. We needed some kind of reform. And honestly, any reform would have fixed our pathetic system and made it better than what it was before. So I give him credit for Obamacare. You know, at the very least, you could say, he gets a half check mark for that because it's better than getting no reform. But then there's other things too. So the Iran deal, for example, agree with that 100%. He cuts off their path to a nuclear weapon, moves us closer to peace. The Cuba deal, for example, that's great. I mean, we've been super anti-Cuba for the longest time, and it's done nothing except embolden the communist regime that they have. And by the way, now that we opened up the lines of communication, guess what? We covered a story recently. Cuba is going to legalize what they call micro-businesses. So now we might all laugh at that. Oh, ha-ha, so they're taking a little baby step in the direction of opening up the economy and having some free markets. But, yeah, I think that's a step in the right direction. I think that's good. I don't think that's something to scoff at. This is an area where you could say, thanks, Obama, and actually mean it. Other things, he's gradually released nonviolent drug offenders. Now, he doesn't go far enough. I would release them all like that. But, you know, he hasn't done that, but he has done something, and he is moving us in the right direction. There are other examples of him tweaking some of the labor laws and raising the minimum wage for people who get federal government contracts. And so, like, I don't want to downplay the good that's done under Obama because there are many areas where we can point to and we could say, well, that's obviously better than if we had a Republican in office. But that being said, yes, in some areas he's let us down, and in some areas he's kind of a typical corporatist Democrat. Like, for example, he's pushing for the TPP, which would be a disaster for the middle class in America. Yes, he's been right on social issues, but, I mean, that's kind of Democrat 101 ideology is, okay, we'll be good on all the social issues so that half the time we can fuck you over on the economic issues. But either way, what this shows you is that, you know, Obama's actually doing way, 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 way better than most presidents do at this point in their presidency. It's true. It is. I mean, George W. Bush had what, a 20-something percent, 30% approval rating? Obama's got like a 56% approval rating. That's almost unheard of for a president at this point in their term. So, yeah, I guess you give a little credit to Obama for where he's at here, and the people say, yeah, I guess I'm kind of comfortable with it, even though they do still want massive fundamental change. They want universal healthcare. They want universal education. They want money out of politics. Look at the polls on this stuff, crystal clear. But overall, they're like, I think he is better than Hillary Clinton or Donald Trump. And on that point, do I agree with the people in the poll? Oh, absolutely. I do think Obama is a little bit to the left of Hillary Clinton on the political spectrum. I do think Hillary Clinton, even though she says, oh, I'll continue Obama's legacy, yada, yada, I do think she'd be a little bit to the right of him, specifically on foreign policy. And he hasn't even been great on foreign policy. So this idea that she'd be to the right of him on that is kind of disastrous. He's done seven interventions. I mean, we have special ops troops on the ground in Iraq, for example. We're still in Afghanistan to this day. You know, the drone war gets 90% the wrong people, according to internal drone memos. So, you know, it's not like this guy's a peacenik. I grant you that Obama does more of the, it's a gross term to even use, but he does more soft imperialism. So, namely, you do drone strikes, you do standard traditional air warfare, bombing missions and stuff like that. In some places, you put special ops forces on the ground. That's the soft imperialism. The neoconservatives are like, let's just fucking ground invade everywhere. Fuck it. Balls to the wall. Let's do it. So that's what they want. That's way worse. Hillary's kind of in the middle between the two. Or if anything, she probably leans more towards just the neocon position. In fact, many prominent neocons have come out and endorsed her in this election. So I think that it really is telling that the American people, usually at a time when they despise whoever, whatever president is in office at this point in their term, they're like, yeah, that guy is almost certainly better than Donald Trump and Hillary Clinton. That's true, and that's really sad, and that shows you something about the nature of our system and how it almost always serves us an option of the lesser of two evils. Okay. All right, now let me squeeze in one more before we take our first break here, and it'll be the hideous Supreme Court decision. We have a hideous Supreme Court decision that happened a few days ago. It was unanimous, which blows my mind. So NPR reports here. In a unanimous decision, the U.S. Supreme Court threw out the corruption conviction of former Virginia Governor Bob McDonnell. Now, Chief Justice John Roberts goes on to explain here. There is no doubt that this case is distasteful, talking about what Bob McDonnell did. It may even be worse than that. But our concern is not with tawdry tales of Ferraris, Rolexes, and ball gowns. It is instead with the broader legal implications of the governor's boundless interpretation of the federal bribery statute. Okay, so I need to fill you in some more on this case here. We've spoken about it before, but I should update you. So NPR continues. McDonald was convicted of taking gifts in excess of $175,000, including a Rolex watch and the catering for his daughter's wedding, in exchange for government favors on behalf of Johnny Williams, a businessman marketing a tobacco-related dietary supplement. Those government favors or official acts were the big issue in this case. The question before the court was whether doing things like setting up meetings, hosting parties, or calling Virginia officials to discuss Williams' business constituted an official act. Okay, so let me break this down and make it as simple as possible for you guys. So you have the governor of Virginia who's got his businessman buddy. His businessman buddy just gives him all the gifts in the world. He's like, okay, here, you can have a Rolex. Okay, here, let me cater your daughter's wedding and not charge you anything. And all you have to do in return is give me these government favors. Now, I mean, that seems to be the most obvious case ever of bribery and corruption. But no. What do the jackasses on the Supreme Court say? Well, I mean, let's get very technical here, guys. See, there needs to be a quid pro quo. And, well, we don't have a quid pro quo here, okay? So that means that maybe he was giving him the gifts because he likes the guy, and he wasn't expecting anything in return, okay? Yeah. See, you'd have to prove that there's a quid pro quo. There's no proof of a quid pro quo, okay? You understand, everybody? You get it? So, in other words, unless you have a businessman and a government official where it's like recorded on video or you have audio and they go up to one another and one of them goes, "Hello there, Mr. Public Official. I am going to give you $175,000 worth of gifts, or just flat out cash in some cases, and I need you to go ahead and try to pass this piece of legislation for me. It is H.R. 7294. So if you can please do these favors for me in exchange for this cash I am giving you, I would really appreciate it." According to the Supreme Court, those are the only instances in which you could say, bribery, corruption, see, see. That is, it's almost like they're trying to be stupid in that decision. It's almost like they're trying to not see plain face reality. Because as I just described to you, a businessman gives a governor a Rolex, caters his daughter's wedding for free. By the way, there's other stories about how he let him use one of his vacation properties. And so he gives him all these gifts, and in return, let his wife go on shopping sprees. That's another thing that they didn't bring up in this article, but I remember from when we covered it last time. In return, he gets, quote, government favors. And they go, "But did you have an actual conversation where one of you says, I will give you the money and then you do these favors in return?" And they go, "Well, no, but we can follow the money and see the actions that happen." They go, "That's not enough. That's not enough. I do not believe that's bribery. I do not believe that's corruption, because you do not have an exact tale of exactly what they said, where one said, I will give you the money and you will do me the favors." Well, then almost nothing is corruption and bribery. So they refuse to connect the dots. They refuse to say, "Oh, well, this is obvious and we can see based on the actions." So it's like they're trying to be dense. They're trying to be obtuse over this. They're like, I don't want to see the plain face reality of it. So for example, you have ExxonMobil. They donate so much money every year, overwhelmingly to Republican politicians. And Republican politicians all the time, lo and behold, look at that, they try to give a $4 billion subsidy to ExxonMobil annually for research and development. Now, to normal people that have functioning brains, you look at that and you go, "Oh, so I see what happens. This is basically a form of bribery. This is a form of corruption. Have campaign contributions, which are totally legitimate, go from ExxonMobil, Chevron, BP, whoever, goes to the politicians, and then they understand, oh, well, there's strings attached to this. They're not just giving me the money because they like my stance on abortion. They're giving me the money so that when that bill comes up to give them $4 billion every year for research and development, I vote in favor of it." According to the jackasses on the Supreme Court, no, 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 la, 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 we refuse to see that, la, 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 la. So for everybody on the Supreme Court, when you had Wall Street giving gigantic campaign contributions to Democrats and Republicans, and then when the crash happened, the Democrats and Republicans came together in a bipartisan fashion and they said, "We're going to bail out Wall Street. Not only that, we're not going to have strings attached to it so that the people who specifically made the decisions that crashed the companies and the world economy get bonuses when they failed miserably. They should be fired, never mind getting paid, never mind getting bonuses on top of that." According to the Supreme Court, no, I see nothing wrong here, nothing fishy there at all. That's not corruption, that's not bribery, because you don't have an exact example of a time and place when they came together and they said, "I am going to give you the money and you are going to do the favors for me." By the way, they're not that stupid. Nobody's that stupid. Everything is implied at this point. Everybody gets the way it works. That's why it's legalized bribery at this point. Everything is implied. All the lobbyists, all the campaign contributions, everything is, oh, so that's how it works. You give me the money, I do this favor for you. Rich people overwhelmingly give to politicians. Lo and behold, look at that. They all get to shove their money in the fucking Cayman Islands in Bermuda and not pay their goddamn taxes. Whereas the middle class, if you're poor, if you don't pay your taxes, you end up in jail. Have you ever noticed when you do it, it's tax dodging? It's tax avoidance? When they do it, they're using a tax haven. Oh, that sounds so much lovelier. As Bill Maher says, it's like their money's getting a suntan. No, it's that they've been able to get away with it because they bought the government. And this isn't theoretical, man. Like, we've covered, there was a Princeton study that found that there's no correlation between what the people want, according to the polls, so normal American people, and what we end up getting. Whereas with the rich, there's almost a perfect correlation between what they want in terms of policy and what they end up getting. I wonder why that is. It's because they pay the politicians. But according to the Supreme Court, because they don't literally sit down face to face and say, I will give you the money and you will do favor X, Y, and Z for me. They go, I don't see how that's bribery. I don't see how that's corruption, because it's implied and they don't say anything to each other. So we can't prove that it's bribery, even though if you trace the money, it's clear that this is all implicit bribery and corruption. So what's so funny is that they had, all of them have these smug comments about how, like, well, if this constitutes bribery, well, then I guess everything that happens in our government is bribery, and that can't be true. Except, no, that is true. In fact, I just explained it. Explained how, yeah, everything is basically functioning as an oligarchy. If you have money, you buy favors. This is the way our government has functioned for so long. But they're working backwards from their conclusion. Because, see, they're doing well on the Supreme Court. They think, well, I guess other people are doing well, right? I guess this is just the way government works. So they view it as a preposterous conclusion that, oh, maybe the entire system is run on legalized bribery, and maybe we live in a functional oligarchy. They're working backwards from the idea that, no, of course we're not. So what do? They smugly say, well, they're not literally saying, I will give you money and you will do favors for me, so it can't be bribery. I mean, if this is bribery, it's like everything is bribery, right? Right? Yeah, that's right. That's not an argument that, oh, it's not happening. It most certainly is happening. Any person with a functioning brain can look at this and say, there's a problem with a businessman giving a Rolex shopping sprees to the wife, letting them cater their daughter's wedding, giving them money, favors, all that stuff. They're not doing it for their health. They're not doing it because they like their fucking smile. They want something in return. That they didn't literally say exactly all the specific things they want does not mean it's not bribery or corruption, but according to the Supreme Court, that is what it means. They need to get their heads out of their asses. Remember, back during, I think it was the Citizens United case, one of the justices said, not only is money in politics not corruption, they said it's not even the appearance of corruption. So they're saying it's illogical to even think that, hey, maybe this is corruption. They go, no, that's illogical to even think it's corruption. It's not even the appearance of corruption. That's what they said. On that alone, I rest my fucking case. You really think these guys know what the fuck they're talking about, and you really think they're making sense? They're telling you it's not even the appearance of corruption, so I leave it up to you. Do you think it is at the very least the appearance of corruption? I got to take a break. We come back. We'll hop back into the Nate Silver issue. And a Democratic senator caught with $70,000 in drug money. What? Stay right there. Yeah. Back, y'all. We are back. All right, let's jump back into this Nate Silver issue. So Nate Silver came out this week with a new prediction on the general election, and it's a little off, if you ask me. So he says that Hillary has a 79% chance of becoming president. Now, yesterday I did a segment on this, and I ended up pulling it from YouTube because I misstated something about Nate in the middle of a rant, and it was unfair to him. So I insinuated that he also thought that she would win with 79% of the vote. And of course, that's ridiculous. He doesn't believe that. He says she has a 79% chance of winning, and that's different. That is a significantly less crazy thing to say. Now, that being said, I still disagree with him. So furthermore, I also understand that the average in the polls does not necessarily equal your probability of winning. And I was not clear about that yesterday. So for example, take Obama in 2012. In one poll, he's up 3 points over Mitt Romney in the weeks leading up to the election. In another poll, he's up 7 points. In another poll, he's up 5 points. And virtually no polls had him down. So as a result of that, Nate Silver quite rightly predicted that Obama had like a 90% chance or thereabouts of winning the general election. And I defended his prediction on that. So I get it. The average that you're up does not necessarily equal your probability of winning the election. So I want to be perfectly clear about that. Now, let me explain to you why, despite all this, I still have Hillary at about 55% chance of winning the election at the moment. Now, that'll change. This will go up and down. But at the moment, I have her as just a slight favorite to win the election. And I do not agree with Nate Silver that it's as high as 79%. I think that's way too high. So, first of all, the polls are all over the place. And as of right now, as Nate recently admitted in a tweet storm about a month or so ago, we're really far out from the election. We're still pretty far out from the election. So to already have it at 79% that Hillary wins, again, I think is too high. And in the past 3 to 4 months, it's not wall-to-wall Hillary winning in the polls. In fact, Trump is up in 5 polls, and it's a statistical tie in 10 more polls. And understand that this isn't just Fox News polls and Rasmussen polls and right-leaning polling organizations. It's also Quinnipiac and ABC News and Washington Post and others. But more than that, he's also competitive, and he's right there in the exact states that he needs to be, the swing states. And Nate, I read Nate's entire piece on his, prediction, his polls plus prediction, and his polls only prediction as to why he has Hillary at about 75 to 80% chance that she'll win. And he even admits in his piece that, well, yeah, but in the swing states, it's actually a more rosy picture for Donald Trump than the overall national poll numbers. Kind of a big factor, if you ask me. Then the third thing is, again, Nate even admits in his piece on this that a possible scenario with Trump, given how his support is spread out across the country, is that he can lose the popular vote and still win the Electoral College. So that's another thing to bear in mind. And then the fourth thing is, honestly, I don't put as much stock in the betting market as Nate does. So that's one of the things that he points to. And don't get me wrong, it's not like it's worth nothing. It's worth something for sure, but I don't weigh it as heavily as he does. And, you know, a good piece of evidence on my side for this is that the betting market, look at it before Brexit. And they were just dead wrong on that. So I wouldn't put too much stock in that. The fifth thing is, dude, Nate has made bold and wrong predictions every step of the way this election. So, for example, he kept saying Trump wouldn't win. And it's not like it was just a one-off thing. It was kind of a theme of his that Trump wouldn't win. So, you know, when people go over the top defending him now, I think, do you not see that on some of the biggest questions he was dead wrong? He put him at a 2% chance of winning. And before you say, oh, well, nobody could have seen it, that's not true. When only three states voted, I said it would be a minor miracle if he didn't win. So that's not right to say, oh, he's been right all along, when he's wrong, everybody else is wrong. That's not the case. So I predicted it when only three states voted, and there were some people who were even earlier than me to it, and they said before the voting even started, they were like, Trump is the overwhelming favorite. And the polls kind of showed that too, by the way. So for him to stick to, at the time, he's not going to win, he's not going to win, he's not going to win, when the polls showed the opposite, it shows that he's really not necessarily as married to empiricism as he would like you to believe. And on top of that, look at Michigan, man. He had Hillary Clinton at a better than 99% chance of winning Michigan, and he was wrong. So the point here is he's made these really bold, strong predictions before, and he's been wrong. Now, the sixth reason, I'm going to keep going here, there's actually a very clear populist fervor in the country this election cycle, and I don't think he factors that in properly. Now, admittedly, and I understand this, that's super hard to quantify. Like, how do you quantify that? How do you measure that? How do you put numbers to that there's this populist fervor in the country? You can't really do it in any way that's, super objective, but it's there, and it's clear that it's there. So I feel like in the absence of a way to quantify that, it's just left off the table in Nate's analysis, and that's one of the reasons why somebody like me has been screaming about how he hasn't done a great job so far. So I would argue that his numbers, while, he says, hey, they're empirical, and this is what I based it on, and you can see how I came to it and whatnot, that's all fine and dandy. But it would be more objective and more empirical if there was some sort of way where we can quantify and calculate just how much this populist fervor is going to affect the outcome on election day. And that's another thing, is the polls that we're looking at, are we talking about polls of, just people in the United States, or are we talking about polls of likely voters? Because then there's a big difference when you look at one versus the other, and there's a million things that go into it, and all this stuff needs to be weighed. So the more information, the better. And when you have no way of sprinkling that into your analysis, I think it's less objective, not more objective. When you have to ignore the populist fervor because, hey, I don't have a way of necessarily factoring that in, like, I get why it's lacking, but then you shouldn't be as bold in your predictions. All right, and the seventh thing here is this. And this is also linked to number six. This is linked to the populist fervor in the country. How they run their campaigns is everything. And he can't really take that into consideration by design. And if anything, I feel like he falls back on the conventional wisdom too much, the conventional wisdom being, for example, that a Democratic candidate in the general election needs to run to the right to get more moderate, independent voters. Now, he's basing that off of previous elections, and I get the logic behind that, but as I've described to you guys before, I think that's a flawed model because that presupposes that the electorate today is in the same mood it was in the 1990s when Bill Clinton did that and he won when he ran as a new Democrat and he triangulated and he said, you know, he's a neoliberal and I agree with the Republicans sometime, I agree with the Democrats sometime. At that time, that was the right time in history for a so-called centrist Democrat to come along. So he could look at that and say, well, that's evidence that that's what people want now. But that doesn't take everything into account, like, for example, the neoconservatives and how disastrous they were, like just how much of this populist fervor we have in the country. And it's hard to quantify how much of an effect it'll have when one person runs a really populist campaign and gets people really excited, and the other person is basically the epitome of the establishment, which people know is fucking them over completely right now. So that's another area, and this is why I think he greatly overestimates Hillary's chances, is there's no way to factor this stuff in, and he doesn't factor this stuff in. So Trump, for example, has repeatedly showed he's moving left. He's moved left on foreign policy. He's moved left on economics. He's been left all along on trade deals, on Medicare, on Social Security. His rhetoric, call it what it is just on point for stuff like this. He says, I'm going to make America great again, and I'm going to do that by keeping your jobs here. I'm done with these stupid trade deals. That's what I'm going to do. I'm going to fight for the American people. Whereas Hillary comes along and it's the same old establishment status quo business as usual bullshit where she's, you know, mealy-mouthed on it. I don't know, trade's kind of a good thing. We got to be smart about how we do trade and trade deals aren't necessarily bad and we shouldn't isolate ourselves from the world. And then also the PC angle of her campaign, how everything is viewed through the spectrum of identity politics. Everything is, I'm the first woman. Isn't that great? Let's break down the barriers. I think that's a paper tiger, man. I think that line of argument is a paper tiger, and it makes many people roll their eyes. And they go, all right, and then what? And then what? You're the first woman, and then what? You'll break down the barriers. What does that mean? So, and when you run a campaign against Donald Trump saying, oh, he uses curse words, as everybody's done to this point, that doesn't work against him. It doesn't work against him. It makes him more popular because we're adults and we don't give a shit about curse words. We care about policy. So you have one person who's moved to the left, one person who's hitting their stride in a populist message, and the other person who's just business as usual and a standard politician, and obviously the mood in the country does not fall in line with that. Now, still, don't get me wrong, even with all this stuff, I do think that Hillary Clinton is a favorite, and I think that based on the numbers and based on the polls. I just think that he overestimates her chances, and I think this is as silly. 79% this far out, based on everything we have, all the information we have, I do think that's as silly as a better than 99% chance in Michigan, and I do think that's as silly as saying that Trump has no chance. So, yeah, I think he's shown he can make bad predictions. Of course, I can make bad predictions too, obviously, but that's a really bold prediction, and I think it's based on limited information, and he needs to factor in more things. So 79% is way too high. And by the way, do a segment against him if, for example, he said, I think she has a 60% chance of winning. I wouldn't be doing this segment. Now, I would still disagree with him because, again, I have heard a slight favorite. I have heard about a 55% chance. But if he said 60% chance, okay, that's still a reasonable thing to say. Like, that's not a crazy thing to say. I wouldn't be doing this segment if he said that. If he said 65%, I wouldn't be doing this segment because that's still a reasonable thing to say. Based on the evidence, that's within the realm of reason to say, oh, yeah, that's possible. Dude, even if he went as far as 70%, I probably wouldn't be doing this segment. But when he says 79% chance that she wins, I don't agree with that, and I think he's missing a lot of factors, and I don't think these predictions are nearly as good as his predictions in 2008 when he was spot on, in 2012 when he was spot on, and he even admitted in this election cycle, I've kind of been off. Yes, I've been off. Now, he still has a very high getting it right percentage. So do I. so do a lot of people because some of them are just no-brainers. But on very important ones, like whether or not Trump would get the nomination and Michigan, he was dead wrong. So, I don't know, a little more humility would be nice. Ticking down that number a tad would be nice. And not doing it based on less information, doing it based on more information. The more you factor in, and again, I know it's hard to factor these things in and quantify it, but the more you factor in, I think the more you realize that number ain't 79%, it's significantly lower than that. Okay. All right, now let me move along to a Democratic senator who was caught red-handed, y'all. So a Democratic senator was caught with $70,000 in drug money. Oh, no, say it ain't so. Apparently we have some drug runners in the Senate. So that's Senator Jeff Merkley. He's a Bernie supporter from Oregon. And, yeah, this one was on purpose. So he was caught with $70,000 in drug money. That was the point. And he and Representative Earl Blumenauer, another Oregon Democrat, did it because they wanted to raise attention for a huge issue about legal weed and banking. So for those of you who don't know, there's this massive discrepancy between federal laws on drugs and state laws, specifically when it comes to marijuana. There's the biggest discrepancy. So I think there's 4 states now that have legal recreational weed and over 20 states that have legal medical marijuana. Well, at a federal level, marijuana is a Schedule I drug, meaning there's no medicinal use, potential medicinal use. It's totally illegal. You can't have it. So since there's the discrepancy, banks, scared of federal prosecution, go, yeah, we're just not going to accept any money that we think is dirty money that comes from, for example, small marijuana businesses in states where it's legal recreationally. So as a direct result of that, they've had to devise all these crazy methods to deal with their cash. And for example, the private security industry in Oregon, in Colorado, it's booming. It's booming because they have like all the cash on them. And they need to have guards all the time, and they need to transfer the money. So Earl Blumenauer and Jeff Merkley were like, let's raise attention to this issue. Let me, you know, do this segment and take these pictures and whatnot with me having $70,000 in drug money, and hopefully we can try to get a change in the federal laws. And by the way, there's another angle to this, which is just mind-blowing, which is there were scandals recently about some of the big banks working with fucking drug cartels, Mexican drug cartels. HSBC was one of them. So apparently the banks will work with drug criminals because they, hey, we can hide that one and that's totally in the dark and whatnot. But when it comes to legal marijuana in the states, they go, oh, I can't touch that. I can't touch that. Because you know why? It's all above the fray and it's all in plain sight. And if the federal government so chooses, they could just say, well, we're just going to crack down on that. We're just going to end that, and we can do it right now. And this is why I've been screaming about this for years now. You can't keep having this discrepancy in the federal marijuana law and the state marijuana laws. Because when there is the discrepancy that exists right now, all you need is one asshole president to come in, and they could shut down everything. Like, I don't think people understand that if the president just decided, I disagree with that, they could shut down all of the legal marijuana in Colorado, all the legal marijuana in Washington, Oregon, Alaska. They could just shut it down. Not only that, if they wanted to, they could shut down medical marijuana too. They could just say, that's it, it's done. Why? Because under federal law, it's already illegal. They just have to enforce it. That simple. So you have to get that changed. And there's a news story. We discussed it yesterday. California might legalize recreational marijuana. Now, my prediction is if that happens, and it's a direct ballot initiative, so people get to vote on it. If that happens, I think it's over. I think it's over. In other words, I think we will have legal marijuana at a federal level sooner or later because you've gone too far down the path. You can't put that genie back in the bottle. So I guess everybody cross your fingers, hope California goes for legalization. But understand that the way the system works right now is ridiculous. There are some people who are serving 20 years life as a result of nonviolent drug crimes, and then there are other people who are running legal recreational marijuana businesses who've largely escaped any punishment, but they have to deal with these crazy banking laws and the discrepancy in the federal law and the state law, so on and so forth. So release all the nonviolent drug offenders, legalize, tax, and regulate. Let's actually be intelligent about this. Okay. All right, let me do one more here, and then we'll take our final break. Then we'll come back, and I'll have a lovely finish for y'all. House Republicans are attempting to ban Democrats from mentioning their gun reform sit-in that they did recently. So Huffington Post explains here, House Republicans are trying to block their Democratic colleagues from mentioning the gun violence sit-in on social media, arguing that the words, quote, sit-in, or photos with signs calling for an end to gun violence, violate rules on official business. So the backstory to this is interesting. There's a Democratic representative who, I guess, posted some of these things on social media, pictures of the sit-in and them holding signs and stuff, and she was told, hey, you can't do that. You can't use the word sit-in. You can't say join our national movement. You can't say we need your energy and passion. You can't say National Day of Action. And you certainly can't do it in an ad, for example, because, quote, rules prohibit members from using official resources to promote rallies or do grassroots organizing. So, I mean, think about that. You want to talk about a perversion of what that was originally intended for. They're trying to censor, they're trying to ban any and all discussion in official business of the Democratic sit-in. Why? Because it makes them look bad. Here's the first sign you know you're winning. This. This shows that on messaging, you can absolutely positively crush them. Now, I was mad. The Democrats stopped their sit-in after, well, I guess 20 hours or something like that. I was mad. First of all, there's 1,000 of you. So why not go in cycles and just stay in there? And then when the Republicans decide we're just going to leave on break, you know how good that makes you look? When you're like, no, we want to fucking fix the problem of gun violence in the country, and these idiots are taking a break. I mean, they're in fucking Key West, they're in Bermuda, and here we are working, trying to save American lives. Look at how callous and unreasonable they are. They don't even want to have a vote on the issues. Okay, if you do that, and you frame it like that, and you hit the media, and you make this argument, you will destroy them. You want to know how I know you'd destroy them? Look at what they're doing here. They're saying, let's try to shut down them even mentioning it. Because if they mention it, everybody in the country is like, yeah, that kind of makes sense. Now, by the way, I think it's fair to disagree with the certain provisions that they were pushing for. Like, for example, the Democrats wanted to stop people on the no-fly list, the terrorist watch list, from getting guns. And as recently came to light, this is a list that's a secret list. There's no due process. So many liberals were like, that's stupid. That's a ridiculous plan. But the other thing they were proposing was universal background checks. I don't see a logical argument against that. In fact, a majority of Democrats, majority of independents, majority of Republicans, and a majority of NRA members agree with universal background checks. So when you do a sit-in and you say, we're just trying to get universal background checks here, and the other guys are like, not even going to let you mention it. Don't mention it. Shut the fuck up. Shut the fuck up. Yeah, they're doing that because they can't beat you in the realm of ideas. They can't beat you when it comes to policy substance. So shut down debate. Shut down debate. Shut down discussion. Don't talk about the sit-in. Don't talk about your policy position. Because when you do, it's so clear that the Republican Party is representing not even the majority of NRA members. They're representing the leadership of the NRA, who are in bed with the gun manufacturers, who pay the politicians to not pass any new gun regulations that would cut into their bottom line and their profits a single penny. So that's the problem here. Now, you can hammer away and you can win, and if you don't give up on this issue, you can coast to a victory in the next election. On this issue alone, man, you got over 90% of the American people with you. To not hammer the Republicans on this would be beyond stupid. Could you imagine the roles reversed? The Republicans have 90% of the American people with them on an issue. First of all, that's never happened. The Republican ideas are just not that popular. So 90%, if the Republicans had 90% with them, you would never hear the end of it. They would do, like, dances on the floor at just gloating about how much they're beloved and the Democrats are terrible and sucky and fascistic for trying to override the will of the American people and all that stuff. So, I mean, it's such an obvious win for you politically and on substance. If you get universal background checks, by the way, you don't keep guns out of the hands of all bad people. Obviously, some are going to slip through the cracks. But it's a statistics game. Like when people say to me, well, yeah, that's not going to stop all mass shootings. Yeah, yeah, no shit. But you know what it's going to do? It's going to tick down the statistics. If you make it harder for bad people to get guns, many of them won't end up getting it. Not all of them, but some of them won't end up getting it simply by having a good universal background check system. So it's a statistics game. You are on the side, Democrats, of saving lives. Republicans are against it. Make that argument. Make that case. And the more they play dirty, the more you call out how they play dirty, and the better you'll do in the next election. This is how politics is played. Okay. We got to take a break. When we come back, we have huge news that broke yesterday about the military. Talk about that. And then also, polling data on Christianity in America. Shock, shock. Christians think they're persecuted. Oh, goodness. Stay right there.
Thank you.
Son of a bitch. All right, we're back, guys. All right, by the way, here's the deal for next week. I kind of spoke about this a little bit yesterday. So next week, I got to sign a bunch of stuff because we got a new studio. And for the next, 10 weeks or so, there's going to be a renovation going on. So I'm going to have my mind in 8,000 different places at once. I got to keep doing the show and then also deal with the renovation and blah, 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 blah. So expect the schedule to be a little weird, you know, for about 10 weeks or so. But for next week, we actually are doing a show on Monday, which is the 4th of July. It's just an hour show. Tuesday, we have a show. It's an hour show. Wednesday, we have a show. It's an hour show. So next week, three shows, Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, hour each show. Thursday, no show, got to sign contracts. Friday, no show, got to get everything, got to get the ball rolling with the renovation, with all the stuff I got to do with the place. So obviously apologize for not being able to do a normal schedule for the next 10 weeks or so, but, you know, we'll be bouncing around and having all these different things because got to do what you got to do to try to get that stuff done. And at some point, there'll be a fundraiser for that. There'll be a fundraiser for the new studio. But for now, if you guys want, we got the Secular Talk shirts that are for sale, limited time. Half the proceeds go to Wolfpack to try to get money out of politics. Half the proceeds go to Lilith Penn of Secular Talk, who does a whole bunch of great stuff. It's booster.com/secular-talk-shirts if you want to take a look at that. And we're flirting with 100 each. So we have the old generation shirts and the new generation shirts. We're flirting with 100 for each, so almost 200 shirts sold. And maybe we're past that. I don't know. I haven't looked yet today. But we were close recently, so. I would be impressed if we got over 200 for both, so a total of 400 shirts. That would be ridiculous. So, see if we can get there. Anyway, let's continue here. Have some huge news that broke yesterday about the military. Let's discuss. We have some big news that broke yesterday about the military. The Hill reports here, transgender troops can serve openly in the military, effective immediately, Defense Secretary Ash Carter announced Thursday. He said, "The reality is we have transgender service members serving in uniform today. Americans who want to serve and can meet our standards should be afforded the opportunity to do so. We have reason to be proud today of what this will mean for our military because it's the right thing to do." They continue here. Under the policy announced Thursday, troops currently in the military can no longer be discharged, separated, or declined reenlistment solely on the basis of gender identity. In 90 days, the Pentagon will issue a guidebook for leaders to follow, and troops will have access to medically necessary care, including surgery. Estimates on the number of transgender troops in the military range from 2,450, according to a 2016 RAND Corporation study, to 8,800, according to a 2014 UCLA Williams Institute study. Okay, so this is really interesting. And honestly, my response on this one is very similar to my response on women in the military in general, which is very simple. If you can meet the standards that they set up, and by the way, this criteria is objective criteria in the sense that they don't tailor it depending on your individual needs. No, you have to meet the criteria. If you can do that, I don't give a fuck what you are. I don't give a fuck what you are, who you are. I don't care if you're, you know, white, black, Hispanic, Asian, purple, female, male, both, neither. I don't give a fuck. As long as you can meet the standards to do the job, any logical argument against it. And any arguments people come up with or, you know, to argue against it, to me, it just seems like rationalizations. You know, like, for example, well, this is going to ruin cohesion. This is going to ruin cohesion within the unit because not everybody's the same. It's just having, you know, two soldiers who don't like each other could ruin unit cohesion. Does that mean that everybody needs to get along perfectly in every unit? And if we don't, then we can't have that unit? Then we'd have no fucking military, because there's always some sort of disturbance at some point. And by the way, if you have an issue with it, get the fuck over it. You know, if you have an issue with, I don't like that person because of who they are, piss off. So, yeah, I don't think, like, people will, of course, will try to spin this as, oh, you're using a, using the military for a social experiment. People made that argument when it first came to black people, allowing black people in the military. Yeah, it's a social experiment. What do you mean? No Negro can follow orders as good as a white boy, and they're just not as trained and equipped, and they're not for this kind of thing. I mean, are we really going to have this discussion in 2016? For example, like, people still make this argument about women. Dude, there are Kurdish all-female brigades that fight against ISIS. The idea that, like, as a general rule, like, just reject all of them because, on average, women are not biologically as strong as men. Like, reject all of them as a result of that. That's just silly. Like, obviously, some of them can meet the criteria. So if they meet the criteria, why would you not allow them in? Same with transgender people. And it's good that we're getting to the point where it's not viewed as, you know, oh, you just have a mental disease. You know, like, there was a time when all gender issues were viewed like that. All gender issues, sexuality issues. There was a time when homosexuality was viewed, that's just a mental illness. Yeah, but then we realized, oh, well, hold on now. There's not, like, there are people, they're gay, and there's not a downside. They're just like, oh, what do you mean? I'm just attracted to the same gender. So is that a problem? Well, they're telling you, I don't think this is really a problem. So why would we call it a problem? It doesn't seem like a problem at all. Same thing with trans people. You know, many trans people, they've reached out to me, seeing some of the segments I've done on trans issues, and they go, yeah, look, I mean, just to make it really simple, I know I am really the other gender. So in other words, you can be born biologically female, but essentially have male wiring. You know you're a man. You have a male brain. So therefore, if you want to live in accordance with that reality, who cares? Who cares? Why is, I don't see what the issue is. For example, if you're a straight man, that's like me telling you every day, I'm going to force you to wake up and like a woman. I'm going to force you to wear a dress. I'm going to force you to wear makeup. I'm going to force you to wear a wig. I'm going to, you know, and you have to talk this certain way that is not how you want to talk. Like, you'd be mortified, right? I know I'm, as a straight man, I'd be mortified. If I had to come out here, wear a dress, you know, I'd be like, no, this isn't who I am. I'm lying to you. Well, trans people have to deal with that every day, where it's like they wake up and it's like, well, here goes another day where I'm not being myself. So then when they finally acknowledge who they are and they come to terms with that and they live in accordance with that reality, then a lot of jackasses in society turn around and yell at them anyway and say, go back to what your miserable state before. It seems super misguided. It seems wrong. As long as they can meet the standards, no, there's no problem here. By the way, if they did lower the standards, then I'd be doing a different segment. Then I'd be saying, oh, well, that's dumb. Then you're just making it easier for them to get in for the sake of letting them in, because you think that's a higher good to let them in than actually have people meet the objective criteria to do the job. Then I'd have an issue. But as it is right now and them not lowering the standards, I have no issue with it whatsoever. It should be celebrated. Okay. Next. We have some new polling data out on Christianity in America, and it solidifies the notion that U.S. Christians have a deep victim complex. So the Atlantic reports here, many, many Christians believe they are subject to religious discrimination in the United States. A new report from the Public Religion Research Institute and Brookings offers evidence. Almost half of Americans say discrimination against Christians is as big of a problem as discrimination against other groups, including blacks and other minorities. Three-quarters of Republicans and Trump supporters said this, and so did nearly 8 out of 10 white evangelical Protestants. So, man, is that telling. 75% of Republicans and Trump supporters say, oh, yeah, the Christians in America are so persecuted. They're victims, man. They're victims. So people have been living on a steady diet of Fox News for decades now, and this is the result. And I think the most important part of this is trying to understand what they view as discrimination. Because it's easy for us to sit here and say, well, that's obviously silly, because it is silly. But how do they define that? How do they view it? And the answer is actually quite simple. They believe it's discrimination if they can't discriminate against you. So they think they have a right to take away your rights. And if you disagree, then you're discriminating against them. So, for example, gay rights, gay marriage. That was the argument they made out in the open for the longest time. They go, no, hold on now. My Christian values tells me that gays shouldn't be allowed to get married. Therefore, if you allow gays to get married, you're discriminating against me and my Christian values. That's the argument. It's that simple. Now, the reality of it is what? Two consenting adults doing what they want when they're not hurting anybody else, that has nothing to do with you. Your religious sentiments cannot be superimposed onto them, and you can't force them to abide by your goofy religious sentiments. But see, that's the thing, is that's how they think. They think, well, this is the worldview, and this is the correct worldview based on this goofy mythological bullshit and this religion. And therefore, if you don't abide by it, you are discriminating against me. And they really say, yeah, discrimination against Christians is just as bad as discrimination against black people, discrimination against other minority groups. I mean, the first thing that comes to mind is remember the resume study for black people? If you have a traditionally black-sounding name versus a traditionally white-sounding name, and you have the resume exactly the same, black people get called back so less often. Like, could you imagine a scenario where, like, a business owner is looking through records? You know, I would hire John here, but I hear he's a Christian. You know how they are, right? Right. That has never happened in America. And let's be clear, that doesn't mean that there isn't Christian persecution in some places in the world. Of course there are. Go to a fundamentalist Muslim country, and yeah, they don't treat Christians very well. They don't treat Jews very well. Certainly don't treat atheists very well. Saudi Arabia says all atheists are terrorists. So this isn't like we're just talking about America here, and that was the purpose of this poll, and that's the purpose of this article in The Atlantic. And the idea that 71% of the country, by the way, is Christian. They describe themselves as Christian. Obviously, it's different kinds of Christians. Some are liberal, some are conservative, some are Protestant, some are Catholic, so on and so forth. But the idea that this overwhelming majority, and remember, the overwhelming majority of presidents have been Christian, the overwhelming majority of people in government today are Christians, the idea that, oh, they're the ones who are suffering the discrimination is beyond ridiculous. And let's remember, there aren't laws on the books in, what is it, five, seven different states that say Christians cannot run for office here. That law does exist. Those laws do exist for atheists. I think it's seven different red states where they say, hey, look, we just have it on the state law books. Atheists aren't allowed to run here. Now, that's unconstitutional because they can't make that determination at the state. That's unconstitutional. Atheists can run anywhere. But the fact that those laws are on the books and nobody like comes along and says, hey, maybe we should fucking take this disgusting language off the law books, that says something. You know, I think if the language was there for Christians, it would have been released like that, or reversed, I should say, or taken off the books like that. But no. So they have a right to take away your rights, and if you disagree with them taking away your rights and being dominant, well, then you're discriminating against them. No, that's not true. And you know who thinks like this? I mean, it is what it is, man. You got to call it out for what it is. Islamists think like this. In Iran, you know, one of my buddies is Iranian, and he talks about this all the time. Like, yeah, they view it as if you disagree with their theocracy and their religious ideology, then you are oppressing them. So they think gays aren't equal and they shouldn't have rights. So if you disagree with that, now you're oppressing me. No, but what about you taking away the rights of gays? You're the one oppressing the gays. No, that's the right thing to do because that's what my religion tells me. Okay, but you don't get to put that on other people. No, they think I do. I do. And if you disagree again, you're oppressing me. So everything is victimhood, everything is oppression, and in every step of the way, they've been dead wrong. You're not oppressed. Get the fuck over yourself. It's 2016. Everybody should be secular. Okay. Next. Let's go to Jeremy Corbyn of the Labour Party and see what's going on in the UK. So labor leader, okay, that sentence makes no sense. Let me try that again. So the labor leader in the UK, Jeremy Corbyn, is being accused of anti-Semitism. Well, that's interesting. Why is that? Well, let me tell you. It's this comment right here. He said, quote, "Our Jewish friends are no more responsible for the actions of Israel or the Netanyahu government than our Muslim friends are for those of various self-styled Islamic states or organizations." Scandal! Ooh, can you believe he said that? So people really are losing their shit over this. Ah, anti-Semite! Anti-Semite! You hate all Jews! You hate all Jews! Okay, here's my favorite fact. When did he make this comment? He made it in a speech on how important it is and vital it is to fight anti-Semitism. So people are going, I don't care that the whole point of the speech was to be against anti-Semitism and to fight it. You didn't do it in the way I wanted you to do it. Therefore, anti-Semite, you hate all Jews. Okay, now, let's break this down here. He's not saying Israel is ISIS or Israel is equal to ISIS. He's saying it is stupid to blame all Jews for the actions of people who are extremists. So Netanyahu, for example, recently launched an attack on Gaza, did a slaughter fest in Gaza, where he killed about 80% civilians, including women and children. Over 500 children were killed. He bombed schools. He bombed hospitals. They bombed the only power plant in Gaza. Kind of a bad move. All the human rights organizations were like, whoa, 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 stop it, stop it. So Corbyn is saying to blame all Jews for that, to be anti-Semitic because Netanyahu is a prick, makes no sense. It is irrational. In the same way that you shouldn't blame all Muslims for the actions of a terrorist group like ISIS. Seems pretty straightforward. He indeed is not saying Netanyahu is equal to ISIS. He is saying all Jews are not responsible for extremists and all Muslims are not responsible for extremists. Seems pretty straightforward. He could have used a different example. So, for example, I live in New York. Not that far from me, there are some areas which are ultra-Orthodox Jewish communities. We've covered stories on the show, a few of them, where one of the things that is done is they circumcise babies. So call it what it is. Let's cut off the tips of baby dicks. And then the rabbis suck the bloody baby dick. That's what they do. Now, sometimes that leads to the baby getting a disease. And there are some instances where the babies have died. Jeremy Corbyn's logic is, hey, do not blame all Jews for the action of the rabbi that just sucked a bloody baby dick and led the baby to die because he gave him a disease. He could have said Netanyahu bombing women and children and going nuts and doing more illegal settlements and taking more Palestinian land. He could have went with that example. He could have went with the bloody baby dick example. But he gave an example. And the point is not that Netanyahu and ISIS are equal. The point is you don't blame all people of one group for the actions of some people in that group. Seems pretty straightforward, but no. People want to use this to argue it's anti-Semitism because they say he's comparing Israel to ISIS. He thinks Israel and ISIS are equal. Obviously, they're not equal. Therefore, he is an anti-Semite. Look, if you think this is anti-Semitism, this cheapens anti-Semitism. You're undermining actual cases of anti-Semitism. For fuck's sake, man, we live in a world where the fucking Golden Dawn Party exists. The crazy Greek neo-Nazi fascists who have their symbology and their flag and all that stuff, it is outwardly Nazi-like, and they tell you they are fascists. They tell you they hate Jews. You're going to put Jeremy Corbyn, a massive liberal, into the category of those people? No, 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 no. How dare you do that? How dare you do that? This is just as stupid as taking somebody who criticizes the doctrine of Islam and saying, oh, they hate all Muslims. You know, so when I come along and I say, oh, It is stupid that in Islam, whether it's in the Quran or the Hadith, they say that semen comes from your backbone. That is stupid. That makes no sense. It is stupid that Muhammad splits the moon in two. He flies on a winged donkey. That is stupid. I think that is incorrect and it didn't happen. So by me criticizing the doctrine of Islam, if somebody says, you hate all Muslims, well, no, that's not true. You made that up. This is exactly what's being done to Jeremy Corbyn. He says something that's very vanilla, very straightforward. Hey, don't blame all Jews for actions of extremists. Don't blame all Muslims for the actions of ISIS. He says something like that. Oh, it's an anti-Semite! 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 We have to stop with faux cries of bigotry. We have to stop with faux cries of racism and xenophobia. Only bring it up when it's accurate, when it's true, when it makes sense, and be clear about the varying degrees of it and the nuance, too. That's not what's happening here. I think these are fake cries of it, and if you're participating, you are undermining actual cases of bigotry, and you might want to read the story Boy Who Cried Wolf. Okay. Keep it going, baby. More the merrier. Story is reporting on a massive gambling bust here. They say four California and New York men have been charged in an internet-based sports gambling ring that handled nearly $1 billion in bets during a single football season and ran a team of employees in Costa Rica. They were charged with crimes including enterprise corruption and first-degree promoting gambling in a 57-count indictment. So they face up to 25 years here, but this is the part that really got under my skin. The Brooklyn District Attorney said the following. Illegal gambling is not a victimless crime. It preys on people's vulnerabilities and directly leads to money laundering, loan sharking, and a host of other crimes. Okay, so first of all, the other crimes that it leads to that you're alleging, those crimes would go away if you legalize, tax, and regulate it. So all the other things that you have to worry about, oh, the black market. So it's a war out there on the black market, and a lot of crimes happen. Yeah, because it's a black market. If it's no longer a black market and you legalize, tax, and regulate, most of the social ills go away. In the same way that that happens when you legalize prostitution, in the same way that that happens when you legalize alcohol, for example, after a prohibition. That's point number one. Point number two is, illegal gambling is not a victimless crime. Yeah, it is. Yeah, it is. Because somebody's making a choice to gamble. So you're accepting the consequences of those actions. Now, are there some people who get addicted, like people get addicted to a million things? Yeah, of course. Should those people seek some sort of help? Yeah, sure. Does that mean you should ban it for everybody who can control themselves and they do it for fun? No, 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 no. So, you know, hey, it's not a victimless crime. Illegal gambling is not a victimless crime. That's like saying eating McDonald's is not a victimless crime. But some people eat a shitload of it, and they have a heart attack at age 43, and they die. Yeah, that was a problem for that guy. But should he be free to make that decision? Yeah, he should. Again, I hope he doesn't, and I hope he eats healthier and lives longer, but he's got that fucking choice. But when it comes to gambling, no, no, no. You can't, I mean, what are you going to take your own money and make your own decisions with it and decide, like, you want to place a bet? Oh, what's wrong with you, criminal? Except that's not criminal. And again, you're cheapening actual crimes when you pretend that's a crime. That's not a crime. That's not a crime. And then I also just got a kick out of them saying, 57-count indictment, that's crazy. But them saying, enterprise corruption, this is. Yeah, no, you know what's more based on corruption? Our government. The legalized bribes that the government gets paid, the politicians get paid from ExxonMobil and Wall Street, and then they turn around and do all their favors for them. But that's totally cool because we're used to it, bro. But oh my God, you run a gambling site where people freely choose to bet on stuff? You're such a criminal, lock you up for 25 years. Fuck out of here. Free these people, man, and legalize gambling. What are we, crazy? Look, I get it. some places, if you build a casino there, it's fucked up. Like, there are some places that are economically downtrodden, and you know, the last thing they need is a casino when people go and they blow their all their money and everybody's in a worse off shape. I get it, I get it. In some places, it's not the smartest idea to put it there. That doesn't mean it shouldn't be legal, taxed, and regulated across the United States. That doesn't mean we shouldn't have the freedom to choose, in the same way you have the freedom to choose whether or not you smoke cigarettes and smoke yourself into an early grave. This one is not hard to figure out, okay? Legalize, tax, and regulate it. By the way, crime would go down over it, and if anybody has problems, they can get help and, you know, see a psychologist or a therapist and work on their own problems, but you don't ban it for everybody because some people go too far. All right, I'm going to squeeze in one more here, and it's going to be Donald Trump. How about that? So Donald Trump was doing a rally in New Hampshire recently, and we have an awesome moment when somebody in the crowd asked him a question.
Okay, the women auxiliary. I think the women like me. I don't know. I see. By the way. Thank you. Yes, go ahead. Go ahead.
Okay, I'm Kathy Schnelly. I'm legislative chairman for the state of New Hampshire.
Good.
DW Auxiliary.
Good.
I want to tell you. I'm sorry. I would like to tell you, I want to thank you, first of all, for everything you've done for the veterans. We all in the VFW know what you've done, even if you don't come out and say it, okay?
What?
Very much we appreciate it. But just to mix quickly, Homeland Security and jobs. Why aren't we putting our military retirees on that border or in TSA? Get rid of all these heebie-jobbies they wear at TSA.
Well,
I've seen them myself.
I understand.
We need
that.
The veterans back in there to take it. They fought for this country and defended it. They'll still do it.
Okay.
Thank you.
You know, and we are looking at that. And we are looking at that. We're looking at a lot of things. I have to tell you, as long as you bring it up, though, in terms of the border, some great people, and Al, you know this, we were endorsed. I was endorsed by 16,500 Border Patrol agents. These are the people that take care of the border.
Okay. That was hilarious. She called them hibby-jobbies. I don't know why we have these hibby-jobbies at the TSA. I've seen them. I've seen them. Okay, I have so many responses to this. First of all, what percentage of TSA people have a hijab, by the way? Not a hibby-jobby, a hijab. What percentage of them? Second of all, yeah, who cares? There are going to be some people who are Muslim working the job. The only way you would have a problem with that is if you actually quite literally believe all Muslims are a problem. Of course, Donald Trump thinks that, and of course, his idiot followers think that. Keep it real. This is why he said, let's ban all Muslims from entering the country. And people in his base went, yeah! They polled this in exit polls when we had the primaries in a bunch of different red states. A majority of Republicans in many states were like, yeah, ban all Muslims from entering the country. That's the mindset right there. Don't even let the hippie jobbies work on that job because it's not good because all Muslims are the problem. And then also, she says, thank you for everything you've done for the vets. By the way, he wasn't doing dick until the media said, you haven't given the money you said you were going to give. And then that day, he wrote the check. Oh, yeah, I did. What are you talking about? And then he gives it, and then he lectures the media. What are you, liars, liars? See, I did it. You only did it because they called you out and said you didn't do it. Okay, so don't talk, oh, he's so great for the vets. He was forced to give the money he said he had already given. Okay, and she says, we want to thank you for that, even though you don't say it. Like, why don't you say it? Why don't you brag about how you helped the troops? Oh, he does that. This just proves to me that some of Trump's followers live on another planet, man. What are you talking about? All he does is brag, I give to charity, I do this, I do that. And by the way, now we know that's the trick he uses. He says everything, I'm raising for charity, I'm raising for charity, I'm raising for charity. When you follow the money, he almost never does. So it's the trick he uses. But look at that. They don't even realize that he brags about this shit. They're like, you don't brag enough. So disconnected from reality, it's hard to wrap your mind around. Okay. Love you guys. Back on Monday. Much love. Mwah. Peace.